Today we have the good fortune of interviewing Father Malachi Martin in his home in New York. And in the first of our interviews, I would like to discuss the church and the new geopolitical situation. We're coming out of the Cold War and we're headed into something else, but I'm not sure really what. So maybe you might have some insights as to what exactly is replacing yes, the Cold War.
Yes, there is. You put it rather correctly, I think. And I'm not saying this in a patronizing fashion, Bernard. I'm saying it because a lot of people can't even formulate it as you formulated it. We are leaving. The Cold War is behind us. There's no doubt about that. There will never be another Cold War like that again. We're heading into something else, which is much more hazardous, in my opinion, by the way. But we're in the transition period, and therefore all we can do is give educated guesses and outline the dim shape of what is taking place. And this new world is geopolitical. That is, it is a world which is dominated by trends that involve several nations at the same time, the same trend. For instance, we had a small example there recently about nuclear development. Hitherto, we've had this tidy little club of England, Britain, France, the United States, China, and Russia, and Israel, because Israel is a member of the nuclear club. They have their missiles tipped with nuclear warheads, and they have the power of delivery. We don't speak about that in public because the Israelis have never admitted it, but we all know it. So there was this tidy club. And lo and behold, the Indians suddenly break loose and they explode bombs. And they're on their way to thermonuclear power. And remember, the India is shortly going to be 1 billion people. It's a huge populous country. And then immediately afterwards, the Pakistanis exploded their bombs, and they're on their way to being fully-fledged members, and they have the means of delivery. They both India and Pakistan, have the means of delivery. Unfortunately, they don't like each other an awful lot, these two countries. They're fighting a continuous war in Kashmir, and one of them is a great friend of China. Pakistan is a great friend of communist China. India is not. India has lost land to China, and it resents and fears China's grip on Tibet. Tibet, as you know, is being extinguished with our connivance. We, the center of democracy and the stronghold of freedom, we are acquiescing totally in the enslavement of Tibet and the crushing of anything like Tibetan language, Tibetan nationality, Tibetan culture. We are acquiescing in that because we're afraid of China. We're afraid of China. And China is the one we want to have a partnership with at the present moment, and for that we will do anything. Even the president of the United States will go to Beijing and celebrate Tiananmen Square, the anniversary of the communist movement. But this is another thing completely. We're not engaged in criticizing the politics of the United States. This is just a statement of fact. So this is a new thing that's geopolitical immediately, because if India and Pakistan have the bomb, Iran is going to have it soon, within a year or 18 months. Iran is going to have it. And if Iran has it, then it imposes a totally new configuration on everything, because they can stride into UN meetings and thump the table and say, no, we disagree. And we can attack too. And that means that, for instance, the geopolitical, the policy of the United States in the Middle East is changed forever. It can no longer rely on Israel because the Arabs are going to have the bomb.
Now, in this new geopolitical world since the Cold War, there have been some attempts to make sense of it. There have been books like The End of History, The Sovereign Individual,
That's right.
The Clash of Civilizations.
Professor Samuel Huntington, yes.
What is your opinion of these attempts to explain the post-Cold War world?
I'll tell you, Bernard, they are not solutions or explanations. They're exposés of the facts. They admit themselves they have no answer. They describe things. They're purely descriptive. Because the authors of those books you've just mentioned fight completely shy of anything to touching human spirit and religion. They will not bring in the religious question. As you know, today the fashion is explain everything, examine everything, analyze everything, describe everything, but without any reference to religion. Any reference whatever. That's the law. And that's why the United States Supreme Court in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, this famous case, came out with a statement that anybody who enters the public square in America with a religious point of view has no place in the public square. No religious ideology, no religious belief has any place in our courts or in our public square. And that applies to England, applies to France and Germany and Italy and Spain and Belgium and Holland and China and India and Pakistan. The same thing. Except you have large bodies like Islam and large bodies like the Catholic Church, which is nominally 1 billion members. And then there is another 500 million Christians between all the Protestant churches and the sects. But they have no longer any say because this geopolitical situation is dominated by one thing and one thing only. That is the flow of capital and the flow of capital goods on a daily basis. No country can stand outside that. Witness what happened to Albania. Witness what happened to North Korea. They were starving. If you don't enter that, if you don't share in the flow of capital and the flow of capital goods, you perish.
So the attempt in the New World Order is to make religion an entirely private matter.
That's right. Completely out of ken and out of account. You can't rely on that. You can't brandish your religion in any way or say, I'm justified in doing what I'm doing because of my belief. No, you can't do that. And you must conform to the new geopolitics of trade. You must share in the capital. You must depend on the IMF. You must depend on the World Bank. You cannot stay apart from it. Your whole economy has to be geared to the flow of capital and the flow of capital goods. Otherwise, you're going to perish.
Does this influence the moral order? For example, could your home country of Ireland, let's say, have its own divorce and abortion laws, and even if it participates, let's say, in the commerce, on the moral question, stand aside, let's say, from the rest of Europe?
No. Europe has accepted Ireland as a member of its European Union, but on condition that it finally produces laws that provide mandated abortion, that approve of domestic partnerships instead of the traditional marriage, same-sex marriages, in other words, and sterilization and contraception. Those are now considered to be human rights. And if you don't grant those, then you're anti-human. You're committing a crime against humanity. And shortly, they hope to have an organization attached to the UN which will enforce these laws and bring anybody who violates them to court as a criminal. And they hope to have a blue-helmeted police force international to go and arrest you. We're moving in that direction.
Could we eventually be headed in the direction where some aspects of our Catholic faith become criminal offenses?
Sure. That if the Church condemns homosexuality, same-sex marriages, and condemns homosexuality, that will be a hate crime. It's already a hate crime. You can't do that. And in a place like New York, by the way, or in Washington, at the normal dinner table, if you show any adversity to contraception, abortion, homosexuality, you're not invited back. You simply don't belong. I thought the question you were going to ask me at that point was very near it, but it's not quite it. It's this, that what's going to happen? Will the Church make a compromise? Or will it go underground? Or what will we do? because it will be that you will not get jobs, you'll be dismissed.
Now, during the Cold War, the church actually did have an active
underground
role to play.
Sure.
What was that role? And I think wasn't John Paul II, he was a player in that.
He was, because you see, the American government, really under Reagan, but even before that, but under President Reagan, they made a special agreement with the Polish underground. And they supplied money and machines and faxes and typewriters and radios and money through the Vatican to finance a huge underground which crippled the Polish government. But that's no longer possible, because now the thing is in the open, and it can't happen like that ever again. And that's why actually one of the difficulties John Paul II is having was that the means by which Poland was saved from communism was a purely secular means. Because, as you know, the average Polish woman has 9 abortions in her life today, and right through the communist period, because abortion is very possible. They still have it. So that it was a purely human organization called Solidarity, Solidarność, which has nothing to do with the church. But the church used it to cripple the government economically, so that finally the communist government had to appeal for help and finally collapsed, and then went into a troika, 3 people governing. And finally then the communist government in Poland, like the communist government in all the Eastern European countries, collapsed economically. And they were beaten economically. Capitalism beat communism economically. And that's why they finally collapsed. But the church did collaborate. However, this is different, because if you can't school your children, if you can't go to the university, if your views are unacceptable in any faculty of the university, whether it's medicine or science or biology or whatever it is, or history or literature, you will be downgraded. You won't get your degree. You'll become an outcast. We become outcasts. And that's what we are facing. There's a further development, though, Bernard, which is far more significant in our geopolitics. It is this. I'm a citizen. I vote. You're a citizen. You vote. The power of my vote is so diminished today, so that the laws passed by my Congress in the United States and the Senate, for instance, and then signed into law by the president, my vote is of infinitesimally smaller value than it was, because in between me and the legislators, there is now a whole series of layers of foreign interests. And de facto, many decisions made by our Congress in the United States and the Senate are at the bidding of non-Americans. They're at the bidding of non-Americans. So my vote is diluted in its power. And that's what's happening. We're becoming increasingly the American liberty, American activities, American outlook is diluted by non-Americans, completely non-Americans, because anyway, the people who make decisions, economic decisions affecting me, are not Americans.
And of course, the same complaint is made in England, where so many of the decisions now are being made by the European Union.
That's right.
And not in Parliament in London.
That's right. And that's the big gamble. Can Britain stay out effectively out of the EU, the European Union? Most people think it cannot. I don't know. I can't predict. Because there's a time limit on all this, Bernard, this new geopolitics. There's a time limit, which is a very, very ominous time limit. It is this. As things are going, most honest and frank commentators say it's going to fall apart. It's going to fall apart. It can't go on. There's too much explosive material in the hands of people who have no scruples whatever. They're not governed by any religion or morality. It's self-profit. And America, the USA, can dilly-dally and have a dalliance with China for the sake of its exports and for the sake of money. But eventually, something is going to give. They say that something is going to give, because not on bread alone doth man live. They don't add, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. But they know that human beings need something else. And there is nothing else on the horizon today but bread and food and employment and dollars and prosperity. And if that can hold, which nobody believes can hold, we can get past the 2000. But nobody believes it's going to. That it's going to collapse and explode. And if it does explode, then we have worldwide depression. And it's not merely the, you know, about the Y2K crisis about the computers. It's not merely that. It's simply the internal moral resistance of nations is going to collapse. And that's apparently what the gamble is, that it won't collapse. And most of the commentators say it must collapse, it can't go on as it's going. So this geopolitical situation can't last. Unfortunately, the steps now being taken are being taken by people who believe strongly in world government. And the day may come when we have to yield 2/3 of our sovereignty in the United States to the United Nations. That may come. And forget the other nations. They're already at the beck and call of the UN.
Now, what we need to discuss is, what is the Vatican's role in all of this?
Well, that Vatican role is very important, and it must be understood very clearly, and has to be understood in terms of John Paul II, this present Papa Wojtyla, as we call him, Papa John Paul II. He is primarily a geopolitician. That's his beef. That's his trade. That's what he's interested in, and he has, over the period of almost 20 years, he's gone around. He's met anybody worth meeting in government. He sat down with them in private as well as in public. He's been acclaimed by nations. I think it's 82 nations he's visited. That's a lot of nations. And they receive officially every time. And he has been enormously successful, attracted huge crowds everywhere. I mean, he is charismatic in that sense. And he has established relationships with all the governments, every one of them, even the most oppositional ones, except the one place he has not succeeded is Russia and China, those two places, because their regard, their tradition is that he is an enemy. And that's why he has failed to be able to go to Russia, which is one of his dearest dreams, by the way, to go to Moscow and to present an icon, a famous icon, Our Lady of Kazan, which he has in Rome, which belongs in Moscow. But they won't allow him in.
Now, John Paul II, as we've mentioned earlier, has been a very effective geopolitical player in the Cold War. Has he been successful in making the transition to the post-Cold War world?
No, he has not. He has not. For the simple reason that he was nurtured in the Cold War. He was educated in the Cold War. And in the techniques of survival in the Cold War and defeat, finally, of Marxism as such. Whereas we're not up against the raw, crude Marxism of the Stalinists. We're up against something else completely. We're up against a creeping materialism based on genuine achievements economically, scientifically, socially, medically. I mean, there are huge advances everywhere. And he's not used to that at all.
Now, is this why he seemed to relish that trip to Cuba? Because it's one of the last places that the Cold War is still going on.
It was. And we must understand, by the way, that his visit to Cuba was done in complete coordination with the State Department of the United States. I mean, the Vatican never makes a move like that unless it consults with the governments concerned. And we're the most concerned government about Cuba. And there's no doubt about it. I was asked to comment in public on it all, and it was quite clear that Castro regarded this as the last fling. It was the last sign of his. It gave him a chance to lambaste America again and propose again the socialization of the world. But he was obviously a little boy in the presence of his father. And he was most humble, actually, and most acquiescent with the Holy Father. There was no effort to... And when the Pope openly criticized Cuban communism, there was no objection to that at all. The microphones were left on, and he wasn't shot at. And he was held in great honor. And obviously, You know what I think, Bernard? But I know somebody is going to attack me for having said this. I think it was a waste of time. Because anything that the Pope could have effected, he could have effected from Rome in Cuba. But it was, again, another magnificent appanage of papal power and papal influence. But that's all it was. It hasn't increased the membership in the church. It hasn't eased things. Right enough, at the Pope's request, Castro has let loose about 300 prisoners, I think. There are many more languishing in the island of Pines, where it is the infamous Cuban prison that he runs, which is a torture chamber. Nothing great was effected by it at all, except that the Cubans suddenly found out that somebody could come in and speak against the system, against the regime, and get away with it. But, you know, they had to teach the Cubans how to make the sign of the cross. They had to teach the Cubans the Our Father and the Hail Mary. It was completely de-Christianized, de-Romanized, de-Catholicized by Castro's people. And Castro himself had to put all his communist cadres in sacks and keep them quiet because they didn't want the Pope at all. But Castro saw a great advantage in it. And the advantage was the pulpit. The pulpit. And then one more thing. Castro is going to die sooner than later. And he did confess to the Pope that he is a sinner and he wants his blessing. So perhaps Christ is touching the heart of this man, Fidel, who's committed so many crimes against humanity and has been the cause of so much killing in Africa and throughout the world, and lies and deceptions and cruelty and torture. I will never forget the books, but that book by Valadares, who was in his prison, who came out and published it in the United States. It's a horrible tale of man's inhumanity to man, directly caused by Fidel. He's been a very bad, bad man. There's no doubt about that.
Now, I want to make a contrast now, which should shed some light on our discussion of the New World Order. The Pope did, let's say, achieve some results from his trip to Cuba, and sure, that there were these 300 people released.
Sure.
A few months later, the Prime Minister of Canada, Jean Chrétien, visited Cuba.
That's right.
And he left empty-handed. Does this show us about, let's say, the power of the church in the world?
You've underlined something which is the residual value of this papacy. The charism of the Holy Father. There's no doubt about it. When you meet this man, even in his present reduced physical condition, because he now is very reduced, you're still overwhelmed by this. He has papal charism. He means something. He signifies something. And I watched, fascinatedly, every scene on CNN and the other shows, which showed Castro in the presence of John Paul II. He was like a little boy with his parish priest, bending down because he's a tall man, and the Pope is bent over. And Castro is behaving like a little boy with his uncle or with his papa, with his parish priest. He really was humble in his presence and addressed him very, very decorously. It is the charism of... And then, you see, he laid it on Castro in private. He laid the obligation on him to exercise some mercy, reminding Castro that you too will need mercy at the throne of God when you die. I mean, somehow he touched the religious chord with Castro. And that brings up the whole point. If your prime minister, Chrétien is his name, isn't it?
Yes.
If he could speak religious language, perhaps he could touch Castro's heart. But he went there as a geopolitician and a prime minister. And Castro has eaten them by the dozen.
Now, doesn't this contrast or series of incidents show that perhaps the architects of the New World Order are going to have a problem with Catholic religion?
Yes, they are. They're going to have a big problem. We must be very perceptive about that problem, though, Bernard. There's no doubt about that the level of corruption amongst Catholics, and there's 1 billion nominal Catholics in the world today, the level of corruption has risen. from the point of view of contraception and sterilization and homosexuality and neglect of the sacraments and neglect of prayer. And that's really chiefly, in my opinion, the fault of the bishops and the priests. But whatever is the cause, there's this level of corruption. But there is this extraordinary resource of Catholicism that can evoke in somebody who hasn't practiced the religion, suddenly inspire him and her. And they come forth and they say, no, we don't want that. We're Christians, we're Catholics, we don't like it. We revolt against it, we go back on our decision. We want to recall you from Parliament or wherever we've elected you. So there is this resource. The only thing is that this Holy Father is incapable of evoking it in the established nations of the world. He's incapable of, for instance, he came to New York and he held a mega mass, really a mega mass in Yonkers. And there's a huge crowd there. And the reporters went around a little afterwards asking the people, what do you think of the Holy Father? Do you like him? Yes, we like him. He's our Pope. And do you like what he says about abortion? No, I don't obey that. Do you go to mass very frequently? Well, now and again when I feel like it. It was the standard answer. So he doesn't evoke that Catholicism. He doesn't evoke that. He evokes loyalty. So the basis of it is there because they're all baptized and they're all within reach of what we call in the church sanctifying grace, the supernatural help of God. But this Pope has not been able to evoke it. He gets huge crowds, whether it's Madrid or Paris or Częstochowa or New York or Atlanta. He gets huge crowds. How many of them go there because of faith? Probably most of them because of some splink of faith in them, some splink of faith, but not because they're fervent practicing Catholics, no. And you know that demographers of religion have a ready figure. They say any world religion, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Shintoism, at any given moment, only 25% are practicing. Only 25%. That rises in moments of crisis and of war, and it falls in eras of prosperity to about 20-25%. So it's normal, probably, because you don't get crusades in the middle of prosperity. You always get crusades at the time when people are hard put. And there was no doubt about it, during the war years, the practice of religion was tremendously high in the countries at war. But once peace came, it went back to its normal 20-25% rate. So that, but there is no doubt about it, there is this residual Catholicism, which is very dangerous for the secular politician. It can turn on him. It can turn on them. And that, but this Pope is not capable of evoking that. He has no support whatever. And that's because of certain characteristics of his papacy. We can enter it, we can describe those later on in another section of this conversation. But he has not got that power. By the way, let me add, he never set out to evoke it. John Paul II never set out to reform morality. Never. He never set out to create huge Catholic movements. No. It's not his wish. He has a completely different idea of what he would like to do. He may not be able to effect it before he dies, because now he's infirm and old, although he's not much older. He's only 1 year older than me, but still he's much more infirm in health. But he may be able to attain it, but he hasn't achieved his goal yet.
Now, this leads us to a question. Pius XII
yes.
would have evoked, let's say, a deeper sense of Catholicism.
Absolutely.
In that the people at that time, let's say, didn't have abortions. They did go to Mass. They did say their rosaries.
Absolutely.
What has happened since then?
Well, within the Catholic Church, what happened was a three-year event from 1962 to 1965 called the Second Vatican Council. That was the beginning, the first step. The second step was the destruction of the old structure of the church. A destruction. It was destroyed.
You mentioned Vatican II, and you have recently written an endorsement of a book called In the Murky Waters of Vatican II.
Yes.
What are the major themes of this book?
The major themes of that book are simple and stark and can be stated in a short sentences, it is this, that by one means or another, for one cause or another, through the instrumentality of one man or another man, the Second Vatican Council succeeded in liquidating any traditional official Catholic resistance to modernism. And this book, In the Murky Waters of the Vatican II, by this Brazilian, young Brazilian, which will finally consist of 11 volumes, we only have one volume now, takes everything said and done at the Vatican Council and analyzes it and shows very clearly that it goes against what the Church used to hold up to the year 1962. And he doesn't say it anywhere particular, but we've all been talking with him, and he agrees with the general formulation today that Vatican Council provoked an apostasy, the apostasy. Now, apostasy is a word that really dates, it was used before him, but it dates from the time of a man called Athanasius, Saint Athanasius, way back in the third and fourth century of this millennium. And he, the apostasy is a Greek word meaning to stand away from, and was used for those to describe the attitude of those who renounced Catholic, basic Catholic dogmas. And this work, In the Murky Waters of the Vatican II, by Guimarães, this brilliant Brazilian young man, shows that on basic doctrines, Vatican stepped away from traditional doctrine. And I can name to you, for instance, marriage, human liberty, the papacy, the nature of the Church, the Blessed Sacrament, Mass. Basic things were abandoned in favor of modernist positions, backed by the present Holy Father.
Could you perhaps give one example of where a traditional position was abandoned?
I think the one which would touch most people would be marriage. It was the traditional belief and teaching of the Church always until Vatican II, the year 1964, actually, to be specific, that the purpose of marriage was the procreation of children. Period. That was the purpose of marriage. I got married to you, my beloved husband, because I wanted to live with you and have children with you. In addition to that, there was the fact that we would console each other. We would love each other, and we would make love, and we would have a happy marriage. But that's a secondary cause, a secondary result. And it was really consolation for us, because having and rearing children, as you probably know by now, better than I do, because I've never had and reared children, is a tough proposition, and you need some support. Adjumentum, as the Latin was. So the marriage, therefore, was instituted for the procreation of children and to provide the partners with adjumentum, with the consolation and help, and something to help them along the road. Vatican II said, no, sorry, marriage has two purposes, the love of the spouses and the procreation of children under certain conditions.
Now, does this change in doctrine perhaps explain why, even in some Catholic countries like Italy, Spain, Poland, birth rates are now below replacement level?
Of course it does. It also explains the fact that, for instance, if you meet in America a normally good, as we say, good Catholic couple going to church and sending their children to school, blah, 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 yada, 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 and but only with two children, 53% of them, we now know, have been sterilized. They've gone in for sterilization completely. After the second child, they're both sterilized. So the idea of the limited marriage called natural family planning, but it's not really is the order of the day. And that's why we have diminished families. We used to have families of 6 and 8 and 10, 17. There's no such thing nowadays except amongst the Irish or the Puerto Ricans, perhaps, traditional groups, or the Orthodox Jews. But they also practice a certain amount of contraception. But that's why the population has gone down. Now, it also means this, though. If the purpose of my getting married to you I'm a young woman and you're a young man. If that purpose is primarily to satisfy me sexually and sensually, well, you know, Bernard, nobody's sexual attraction lasts that length of time. It varies with age. And I'm going to finally lose interest in you because there's somebody else comes along and he's far more exciting. So if my purpose was to enjoy myself as a wife or as a husband, that's a sandy foundation because I'm going to meet somebody who's far better than you, especially when we're both over 35, heading for into 40, and I need extra stimulation, especially men. And that's why you find that men, towards about 40, 45, start divorcing and getting remarried. Women too, but men chiefly, because they haven't got the tie that women have to a marriage. So this is direct. Remember, the Pius XII declared it to be de fide, that is, of faith, that the purpose of marriage was only procreation, with the proviso of the adjuvantum, the help, but only as a secondary thing. The primary purpose was procreation. Now it's a question of love. And therefore love, if I don't love you anymore, then I go to a marriage council in the diocese and they say, well, your marriage wasn't sacramental. You weren't mature. And they give me an annulment. And a far worse thing people don't realize, in the year 1968, there were just over 300 marriage annulments in the entire world. In 1997, as of date, do you know how many annulments there were in the United States alone? Over 58,000. 58,000 annulments. And we all know that this is merely divorce Catholic style.
So that's
you asked for an example of one thing changed by Vatican II. That's it.
So the difficulty with Vatican II is more than a problem of misinterpretation. The problem is right with the documents.
Right with the documents. For instance, take another one, very simple one, which is very important. The Catholic Church has always taught, and by the way, there's no major religion that hasn't taught the same thing. It has always taught that you have no right to be in error. You can't go around proclaiming your error as perfectly legitimate. That's the law of the Church. If you're in error, you're in error, period. Vatican II said no. In its doctrine on liberty, you're totally free. And nobody can say you're wrong in supporting error about anything. The human liberty is such that it covers everything. That's against doctrine of the Church, because that means that I can be erroneous and say, well, the Catholic Church is not the true church, or the priesthood is not the true priesthood, or this bread and wine is not the body and blood of our Lord after Mass. And I have a right to believe that. The Catholic Church says no, but the doctrine on liberty says yes, you have a right. And therefore that affects one big law. Outside the Church, there's no salvation. That now is a hate crime.
Now, has this change perhaps led to the great inroads that Protestantism seems to be making in Latin America?
Yeah, of course. Of course it has. That's exactly what they're preaching. That's exactly what the Protestant churches and sects preach. They say, well, we're going to give you freedom. The Catholic Church is narrow and makes you think in one way only, and they only have salvation, and you're free. And you can, if you're, by the way, we both know, you and I, as North Americans, we both know that in the Episcopal Church, for instance, it's a small church, it's only 4.5 or 5 million today, but in the Episcopal Church, there's only one thing you can't say. You can't say that Episcopal Church is wrong, but you can hold anything else and still be a member in good standing of the Episcopal Church. Everything is permitted because you are free, and Vatican II adopted that also. So that's a very serious thing because it also applies to governments. It applies, for instance, to the Catholics who voted for Bill Clinton, knowing well that he's an abortionist, knowing well that he has the morality of an alley cat, but they voted 57% of the Catholic vote went to Bill Clinton twice in the two presidential elections because morality doesn't enter into it. He's free, and we're free.
But the bishops didn't speak out against him.
For the same reason. For the same reason. And it's like the Irish bishops, when they had a vote in Ireland about abortion, you know what the bishops told the people? Make up your own mind. Make up your own mind? But that's the fruit of this doctrine of liberty. That's the fruit. Actually, Bernard, the doctrine of the Church has always been, I am not free to choose error. Not only that, my liberty consists in the ability to choose to do what is right. It's not simply license. And this is the document of license, human liberty. And that's what the Supreme Court said in that case I alleged, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which I would love to write a book about, but I haven't got the time. In other words, that you are free today, the court said, to make up your own mind about life, death, love, hate, war, peace. You're free. You need have no restrictions from anybody. You make up your own mind. That's human liberty today. And that's not the liberty, by the way, of the founding fathers of America. And it's not the liberty the Church has always proposed. But the Vatican II endorsed that.
Now, were you present at the Second Vatican Council?
Yes, I was.
And were there any events there that disturbed you, even at that time?
Yes, there was. The fact that everything was arranged behind the scenes. We were carefully herded. And any counter-movement, for instance, 500 or 600 of the bishops there composed a document for John the 23rd and Paul the 6th, the Pope who came after John the 23rd, asking him to bless their proposal to condemn Marxism. The Pope crushed that idea. There was no question of that being done. He wouldn't allow that. Why? Because he didn't want to offend Nikita Khrushchev. He didn't want to offend the Soviets. Then, for instance, they would go so far when somebody like Cardinal Ottaviani was the leader of the traditionalists, when he started speaking out against the conditions in which the council now labored, I remember his words, they cut off the microphone. He couldn't be heard. And then the Pope was always on the side of the non-traditionalists, of the progressives, always. And he put the direction of the council in the hands of Cardinal Sunens of Belgium, who was so far left that you couldn't see his behind.
And this was true both of John the 23rd and Paul the 6th?
Both of them, yeah, it was. And you see, then there was this terrible thing that, as Paul the 6th said, the purpose of the council was to prepare the Church to help man to build his human habitat, his human paradise on earth. That was the purpose. And remember, that's the whole theme of Gaudium et Spes, the document composed by the present Holy Father, which is the blueprint for the modern Church, into which we should someday do a tape on that and that alone. We should do a conversation on that. But so Vatican II, also, you see, the nature of the Church. For instance, the Church was always composed of the faithful headed by Peter, the Pope. And under him there were the bishops. And the bishops were subject to the Pope and could not go against the Pope in doctrinal matters. Vatican II changed all that. It said the bishops shared the same power as the Pope. It changed the entire face of jurisdiction. The result was that a bishop like Bishop Untner of Saginaw, or Clark of Rochester here in the United States, or Mahoney in Los Angeles, can thumb their noses at Rome. And Rome can't do anything about it. Because they now enjoy, according to Vatican II, the same power as the Pope, same universal power.
Does this explain why Rome never seems to be able to take any real action against, heretics?
Of course, because there are no such things as heretics. You're free. Now, if you really go to extremes, there was this man in Ceylon, Sri Lanka, there last year, Balasuriya, who was making a complete fool of himself. And they had to say, come on, Jesus. But he was reinstated very fast. The only one excommunicated by the Church of John Paul II is Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, the founder of the Pius X Institute. The only one excommunicated, really. The only prominent man excommunicated.
So the only real crime then is to hold to tradition.
And to say so, that the tradition dominates what Vatican II decided. There's this point about the whole thing which we must tell our listeners, and it's this. Vatican II was not a dogmatic council. Both the Pope, Paul the VI, and John Paul II, and the council itself said openly and nakedly, This is not dogma. This is merely a pastoral council. We're giving our opinions, not dogma. Nothing is laid down that you must hold on faith. Nothing is laid down. The result is that the ambiguity is huge. And it infects both the new canon law, published in 1983 by the present Pope, and the Universal Catechism, which is full of ambiguity. You can really choose and pick cafeteria style. You can choose and pick what you want to believe. And they do. And they do. But now that has gone so far that it is safe to say, and this may surprise you or may sort of disturb you slightly, of the 1 billion Roman Catholics in the world, I remember most of those are in the Western world, 1/3 of them is in Latin America, due to the malfeasance of bishops and the neglect of three popes, John 23rd, Paul VI, and John Paul II, the majority of 1 billion, what's that? Oh, I suppose 700 million are in apostasy and they don't know it. They don't know it. They've been taught the wrong doctrine. They no longer believe in the Blessed Sacrament as we used to. They no longer believe in the sacraments as such, like extreme unction, because the church doesn't teach that. The bishops don't teach that any longer. They don't believe in hell. They don't believe in the devil. The bishops don't teach that any longer. You take this example in this country here. Do you think that if the six cardinals in America and the 270 bishops, if they took to the streets, they couldn't change the abortion law? Of course they could. And the homosexuals can do that and change the law, and the Jews can do that and change the Congress, but Catholics cannot do it because the bishops will not give the leadership. No, we're poorly led by a crowd of bishops who, on the whole, are terribly ignorant theologically and who are in for a good time. And after all, look, Bernard, if you can lift the phone and call for a loan to the local bank and get it, ipso facto, if you've got a limo always at your disposal, if you've got money coming in, the nickels and dimes of the faithful, and you're honored and somebody kisses your ring and you're always, people stand aside for the bishop, hey, that's corrupting. That's corrupting. Because you're not really put to the pin of your collar to do anything.
So what has happened to the church since Vatican II is essentially it's like a lion that's had its claws taken out for whatever reason.
Yes, and also that it's been de-Catholicized. They no longer believe that. They don't believe in the Blessed Sacrament. They just don't believe in the presence of Christ in the Eucharist. They don't believe that. And they believe that everybody goes to heaven. God is too good. And if you're divorced and remarried, it's okay. The bishops are a bit snotty about that. But de facto, that's quite okay. You can get married and have children and go to church. And many prominent Catholics do. But it's not emphasized any longer, you know?
So really what you've described then is a situation where the church, the institution of the church has become a facade.
Become a facade, but it's worse than that, really, because here's the difficulty. John Paul II's geopolitics, one cardinal principle of it was to be a member of the international community, the international political community. And therefore, it is very important in his eyes to be a member of the United Nations, to be at least to have observer status. It's very important that they maintain good relations with governments in the United Nations, like the European governments, who are all pro-abortion and who say there's nothing wrong with homosexual marriages and who support sterilization and who have no scruple whatever about school teaching. They don't want religion in schools, but we must maintain relations with them. But why don't we protest? Why don't we make life very difficult for them? Pius XI did. Pius XII did, continually hammered them through the bishops and themselves directly, the popes. But we don't do that any longer because we want to be along. So we're in it, we go along in order to get along. And that's John Paul II.
Now, I want to ask another question that relates to, let's say, John Paul II's geopolitics.
Yeah.
And we had mentioned Russia. earlier. Is it true that Rome has signed some type of agreement where it has said it will not evangelize in Russia?
We have signed an agreement, and we signed it in a town in Lebanon called Balabant. And the agreement is this, that no Roman missionary, no Roman Catholic missionary will ever try and convert Russian Orthodox or Greek Orthodox. It's a violation of their rights. The movement behind that is that we're all branches of Christianity. Leave them alone, they'll leave us alone. And the Israelis, as you know, have enforced the same law in Israel. There's to be no evangelization. There's no proselytism. If a Catholic priest is found trying to convert a Jew, he's expelled. It's a sin against the state. And we have signed that agreement with Israel, the Vatican has, that we will not violate that rule. So we're agreeing to have our hands manacled, our feet tied. We no longer are free, whereas they're free to propagate anything they want. Now, the Pope goes along with all that. He has signed those agreements. And what's his name? There's a Cardinal Cassidy there. He's an Australian. But he's in charge of ecumenical relations for the Pope. He has signed an agreement recently with the old Catholics. Now, the old Catholics don't believe in the papacy, in the papal infallibility. But he has signed an agreement with them, permitting them to have Holy Communion and Mass in Catholic churches. The entire facade has crumbled in Rome.
So the policy in Russia is just part of a larger policy, and it might also explain, let's say, why Rome doesn't try to take advantage of, let's say, the implosion of the Church of England.
That's right. There's no. It doesn't. The policy is totally fit in, go along, get along in order to go along with them, in order to get along with them.
So we want to be a member of the club.
That's right, and we are. We are a member of the club. We are a member of the club. For instance, really, did the bishops make any difficulty about this partial birth abortion? That with this terrible issue where a baby is half born and then you kill it in order to have its intact body for harvesting the organs. We really didn't protest about that. Not really. We didn't object to it. Father Marx did. HLI, Human Life International, did. And single Catholic organizations did, but not the bishops. There's no unified stance on all that. And a man like Cardinal Bernardine, for instance, who's dead now, when he was Archbishop of Cincinnati, he actually forbade the Catholics to protest abortions. He didn't want anything like that. He must have smooth relations with everybody, including Planned Parenthood and the abortion mill owners and propagators. So there's been a total collapse of the church men, not the church itself, the church men. Because, you know, Bernard, in all this, let's remind our listeners of a very basic fact. The church is composed in its essence and its reality of three groups of people. People in purgatory who are in a state of grace but being purged of their sins, their punishment. People in heaven who have attained heaven and are purified and in the sight of God. And then us poor miserable idiots on earth, the church militant, who are not yet dead and not yet in heaven. We are the church. And we are headed by the Vicar of Christ, and that's the Bishop of Rome. And we have an unbroken line of 264 people going back to the historic figure of Jesus and Peter. We have that. That's our big link with the historical Jesus. Without them, that line, we have no connection with Jesus, historically. We have that. The church then has bishops and priests. They're church men. They're not the church. And we're often talking about, why doesn't the church do this? Why doesn't the church do that? Why doesn't the church do this? It's church men who've done it in their sins and their weakness. And so we must always make that distinction between the church. If you got off the boat in Alexandria in 120 AD with your little bag and said to the men at the quayside, where's the Catholic Church? They'd look and say, what do you mean Catholic Church? They didn't know it. And then when you talked a little more, they'd say, oh, yes, that's, They meet down there in the poor section. There are kind of fishermen and slaves and sanitation men and old women. And they have a celebration every Friday and Saturday and Sunday. And they read letters from somebody in Rome. They have a fellow in Rome, they say, is their head. And they have an episcopus. They have a bishop here and a priest. And they sing funny hymns. And they don't sacrifice any animals. They're not that type. They have something else. We don't know what it is. That was the church. That was the church active in that time.
Now, if you move, let's say, 200-300 years ahead, let's say in Alexandria itself.
Then you had the establishment of the church by law under Constantine, and then you had churches being built openly and priests being ordained at a young age, because in those early days they simply took married men and ordained them. They had to have priests.
In that particular area, you had Athanasius, who again
had to operate
pretty much like the Church of the Catacombs did 300 years before.
Because there was a heresy called Arianism, and it was taking everybody. It took 80% of the bishops. And Arianism said that Christ wasn't God. Only the Father and the Holy Ghost were God. Jesus wasn't. So he had to fight Arianism, which had penetrated 80% of the bishops. But they tossed that off because the people revolted against this doctrine. They knew Jesus was God and is God. And they contended with the apostasy. That was the beginning of the apostasy. We are in a different apostasy. We're in an apostasy where the basic dogmas are eliminated from normal Catholic life. People do not believe any longer that Christ is the bread and the wine. They don't believe it any longer.
Does this explain, let's say, why you have situations in some churches where the blood of Christ is just dumped down the sink without any thought about it?
One bishop we know, I can give this document to anybody who wants it, Rembrandt Weakland of Milwaukee, he put out a notice to his parish priests and his diocese saying that when you have any wine left over after Mass, what do you do with it? You go to the cold faucet. You put on the cold faucet, you put the chalice beneath it until it dilutes the wine completely. Now, don't tell me that he believed it was the blood of Christ. Don't even think it. He doesn't. He thinks it's sort of holy wine or something, and you shouldn't. You should dilute it and send it down the drain. But they don't believe that. They don't believe the Pope is infallible. That's no longer believed. Then the idea of celibacy. Well, that's sort of, that's sort of frowned on as being unmanly and inhuman. Everybody should be able to be married, according to the modern. This is Catholic. And then once we have two children, that's enough. We've done our piece. But there's a breakdown in faith and belief. It's called apostasy, and it means that you're outside the church living, and that's what's happened. Now, unfortunately, we are backing into the international organizations. We insist on being a part of it. We should be fleeing it as a church.